This is CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. My name is Kingsley Kipuri, and I'm back with you as always. Really excited to be back. I was away last week, attempting to inspire some of the young people from around the country. So really excited to be back in studio. Mr. Greg Nicholson, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to be back in here, especially after I had to sort of hold things down for a week on my own.
I was a bit worried that there might not be room for me when I got back. I was just kind of hoping that you did well, but not too well.
Luckily, you're the only one who knows how to use these, all the buttons in front of you, so I think, I'm never going to be taking over, not anytime soon.
I think based on the frequent awkward silences and mistakes that happened during the show, anybody listening completely understands that I don't really know what I'm doing behind the desk. As Bongila producers is looking at me with a very disappointed face. Anyway, remember, at DM Shows Edit, that's where we are. Always wonderful tweeting and talking to you on there. Also great feedback about people listening in from different platforms. And so we've heard there's some quality differences, people on apps and people on iTunes and just different. So if you're having any issues sort of hearing us on different platforms, please just tweet us or email us on dmshowzeday@gmail.com and we can figure out what's going on just to make sure that you're hearing this voice in crisp HD. Is it still HD if it's audio? Is that still called HD? All right, that's Greg's input on that. All right, Greg. Let's jump in. The talk of South Africa over the past couple of weeks has been focused on one, Cloudy Motsene, the COO of South African Broadcasting Corporation, our public broadcaster here. And the outcry started, the most recent outcry, because he has a bit of a history, has been around the decision that the SABC should not broadcast violent protests. Right, so blanket decision to say if that's what's going on, if it's violent, if it's a protest, whether it's communities protesting about service delivery, about water, electricity, doesn't matter. We do not broadcast that. And started out with a few jokes of saying, the SABC will just, you know, sort of be portraying South Africa as being all sunshine and roses when it's really not. So it started out lightly. And then really the deep response was like, that is not okay. Right, that's you can't be the largest sort of news source for the country and have that kind of blanket decision. Now, quite recently, we saw a ruling from ICASA, and I know you've been sort of digging into that ruling and what it means. Could you just talk us through that a bit?
Yeah, so I think it was Media Monitoring Africa, the Freedom of Expression Institute, and the SOS Coalition, which has been very active in campaigning for change at the SABC, took this issue, this decision not to broadcast footage of people. It's actually a little bit even confusing, the different interpretations of this SABC policy, but at its basics, it says that it wouldn't broadcast any footage of people burning public institutions or public property. But then that seems to have sort of spiraled out into a ban on burning and or ban on violence at protests. And I think we saw this sort of it was really displayed with the Tswane process over the ANC list and mayoral nominations, where the SABC lacked any significant coverage of the sort of severe violence. And so these groups took the issue to the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa and basically said they were arguing that it was unconstitutional, it violated the Broadcasting Act and the Broadcasting Code, and it also went against the policy, violated the SABC's own license agreement. Now, the SABC, as it generally is prone to do these days, argued vehemently in its defense, but with few sort of substantial arguments. They said that this policy is justified because it prevents copycat behavior and others burning and doing the same, and prevents children from seeing such destruction and then repeating that behavior. And it also prevents an unnecessary tarnishing of the country's image, which could hurt investment and so on. That was the gist of their defense. They didn't have any evidence, so statistical information or anything like that, to show how it would have, you know, how this sort of showing this destruction can lead to further protests and further violence. But then, sort of after a bit of a wait, you know, last week everyone was waiting outside of ICASA thinking this ruling is going to come out. I think it was last Thursday, but it only came out yesterday, and the judgment was, you know, it was pretty straightforward. Let me just read you a quick quote.
Yeah.
Said, the order of the SABC places an absolute ban on a subject. A subject as such may never be blocked from SABC television or radio. South Africa is not, as in the apartheid era, a dictatorship. So ICASA found that such sort of information and footage of violent protests are in the public interest, and the SABC has a duty as the public broadcaster, both under the Broadcasting Act, its licensing agreement, and the Constitution, to ensure that South Africans are informed about what's going on and that they have the right to access information and sort of do with that, you know, what they will, make their public decisions in that sort of manner. So ICASA ruled that the SABC has to withdraw this policy from the data was taken, I think, in late May. Mm. And it can... If they don't decide that, I think they've got 7 days to comply. If they don't comply with that, penalties can include, I think, a warning, a fine, or the suspension or even revoking of their license.
I mean, there's just so much to unpack there. I'm just trying to think of where to even start. First, I'm really interested in this idea of who's actually in charge of the SABC, because it seems like Claudio Motsoeneng seems to be able to do whatever he wants, at least, and seems very confident in the decisions he's making, even when they're ruled to be against the policies of the country, against the rule of the country. He seems extremely confident going forward and still defending those decisions today. So that looks like a man who kind of knows what he's doing. We don't know what he's doing, but he seems like he's got a plan.
I think the SABC in general, but particularly Claudio Motsoeneng, is sort of like, you know, when you get into an argument and you get halfway through the argument and you realize you're wrong. But the arguments got so heated that you only dig deeper into your position. Okay. And you keep on arguing it stronger and stronger and stronger. All the while, in the back of your head, you sort of know that, like, I'm probably not going to win this thing. But if I keep arguing strong enough and I use the right sort of strategies, maybe I can at least hold some sort of dignity. But so you're right. I think you're right. Yeah, I think that... Obviously, we have the Minister Faith Mutambi. We've got the SABC chairman, Professor Umbulaheni Maguve. There's the new acting CEO, I think James Aguma is his name, at the public broadcaster. And then there's the COO, Chief Operating Officer Claudi. And while it seems like there should be all these other, you know, the board and the chairman.
Surely, yeah.
CEO.
You make a decision like that, surely.
Really just seems like Cloudy's running the thing. Yeah. Like, obviously, you can't take the decisions completely individually, because they have to be approved by the board and things like that. But I think what he's done is managed to really sort of win over the right allies at the right time. And particularly for him, I think his key benefit is that he's now... through after multiple sort of board changes in the past, he's now got the support of the board, as well as Minister Faith Mutambi, and all of these sort of other positions around him have just been sort of rotating as to do they support him, do they not, can people stay there and put up with all the stuff that's going on or not, and so he does appear to sort of rule with what appears to be little accountability to others, except the minister. And as long as he's got the minister in his favour, he apparently can basically do whatever he wants, unless this case where it gets called out.
I mean, I'm interested, I'm glad you brought up sort of the senior leadership and so on. I'm interested in this relationship between the ANC and Claudio Motsoeneng, in that I've seen some articles alleging that the ruling party and the state would be fully for a kind of policy that at least minimizes the televising of protests and violent protests, and Cloudy's only crime was perhaps being too brazen and being too aggressive about it. But in terms of the intent behind it, of trying to sort of in the lead up to a local election and trying to make it seem that everything is okay, that's really something that the ruling party could use. What do you say to that?
Well, the ANC's position on this has obviously been a little bit confusing, because the Minister Faith Mutambi, came out in support of this rule, the policy on protests. ANC spokesperson Zizi Kodwa at the time welcomed the decision and appeared supportive. And then, as this sort of issue reached fever pitch, you know, and the resignation of acting CEO Jimmy Matthews came, as well as the suspension of a number of journalists, protests, the ruling, when the ruling was sort of with the whole ICASA issue was sort of happening too, we saw the ANC through its subcommittee on communications, the leader of that, Jackson Mdembu, come out and spoke very harshly against what he clearly deemed censorship at the SABC. Yeah. And he also spoke about the huge problems in senior management and at the board. And the ANC in the past has also spoken about all these sort of problems. And in a statement today, the ANC's National Working Committee, its top leaders, excuse me, said it welcomed the ICASA judgment.
Yeah.
And it also pointed out some of the sort of systemic problems at the SABC and pointed out the ANC in the past back to its sort of read to govern principles before it even came into government in 94. It pointed out that it supported media freedom and this should continue. So it is quite confusing. It seems they're trying to get the party in line to particularly support media freedom, right to expression and the right to information. But the challenge is the minister doesn't seem... we'll have to really sort of see how this thing pans out. But at the moment, it doesn't really seem like she's jumping on board. So the meeting that she was supposedly going to be summoned to at Lutuli House yesterday, which Jackson Mdembu said was a sign that the ANC and this subcommittee that he runs has some power over its minister and can influence her. Because in the past, she's ignored their decisions and just done her own thing in government. But then she didn't turn up for the meeting yesterday. The ANC played it down and said other officials weren't also present. Mm. But until they can get the minister in line on what seems to be becoming the broader ANC position, or get the president to act and tell the minister what to do or remove her and replace her, it's hard to see any swift resolution to some of the leadership crises at the SABC.
When I hear you, man, I'm surprised that you said leadership crisis at the SABC. I thought you were going to say leadership crisis in the country. And I know sometimes it feels like sort of hyperbole, but on the other hand, it feels like a lot of our challenges really just come down to leadership that we can trust to uphold the rules that they're supposed to, and who do what. It's just as simple as do we believe that our leaders play within the rules that they're elected to sort of play within, and it seems that. At least the national sentiment seems to feel that we can't always have that faith in them.
Well, I was actually thinking just before we went on air about the parallels between the Khlari Motsoeneng's response and the SABC's response to the ICASA ruling, because they basically said they were challenged in court, but they took the complete line that they had defending this policy before the ruling came out. So they just said, we're not censoring anything. There's nothing wrong with our policy. It's just these other people trying to meddle in the SAC's operations and use it for their own gains. And I was thinking about the parallels between that and the defense certain ANC members and leaders put up for the president when the president was being harshly criticized for failing to comply with the public protectors and Kandler recommendations.
Yep.
And it's sort of seen the same sort of thing. It's sort of digging your heels and argue on any way you can and on any strategy or any topic you can to avoid accountability and prolong this until essentially it reaches a point where you can't anymore sort of deny responsibility. And in that case, it was the Constitutional Court, and that could be where things are headed with the SABC.
I mean, that's a great parallel. I remember the famous press conference, or now famous press conference, where the states and the president's sort of, I don't say henchmen, tried to convince us that the swimming pool was a fire pool. And now you have somebody trying to convince you that they don't display protest because of the effect that it will have on children.
It's that sort of mind-boggling argument. But then at the same time, got to respect Motsoeneng and his crew because they've stuck to their guns so fiercely, sort of a ICASA ruling, what a ICASA ruling, you know?
I mean, like the copycat thing, I'm just trying to think if I'm... Like, I think that's so belittling of people. Like, it's funny, but it's so belittling to say that we don't show communities protesting because other communities will then protest. And for me, I think that's so belittling because you're almost saying communities protest because it's fun or because they saw someone else do it. Communities protest because they don't have flushing toilets, because they don't have water, they don't have electricity, they don't have education. And it's, I think it's just so ridiculous and so insulting to say that you're not going to televise it because somebody else might decide that it's fun to protest. I think that's extremely insulting.
Editors around the country have to make decisions about about what sort of violence and what types of images that they will publish. And sometimes images of violence and sort of gruesome deaths and things like that can sometimes be decided not to be in the public interest to be shown and can do more harm than good. But a blanket ban like this from the SABC with those justifications, I think is ridiculous. But I think if the SABC truly does believe this sort of copycat argument, what it must do is go and commission studies and find out what experts say and how this actually works, rather than Claudine Watson-Eng just coming to us and telling us what he thinks and then implying that and imposing that on the biggest media company in the country.
I hear you. All right. I think that's that on that. If you're just tuning in to Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central, we're just talking about Claudine Watson-Eng and what's going on at the SABC. We had the blanket ban on televising any violent protests, and that's been sort of ruled as not being something that it was in the powers of the CEO to decide on. So that's something we're going to continue to watch. I mean, and Greg's writing really great sort of work about that, so we'll just keep following that. Okay, now to change countries a bit, we're going to talk a bit about what's happening in Kenya. We're just trying to get somebody from Nairobi on the line right now, but just to give some context, a couple of weeks ago, a lawyer who was trying a case about police abuse. So an individual had some abuse by the police and was basically wrongfully charged. And the lawyer who took up that case went missing. And the lawyer and the driver and the person in question who actually filed the case against the police were then found dead, bodies at the bottom of a river. And sort of very mafia style. I'm sorry, this is quite tragic, but we have hands and legs tied. We have eyes gouged out. And it was really sort of really terrifying to see. And that's caused massive uproar in Nairobi, in Kenya, and from different sectors and quarters about policing, police brutality, extrajudicial killings, and just the role of the police, which is really something that we're talking about internationally, not just in Kenya or in Africa. So on the line, we have photojournalist, activist Boniface Mwangi to give us a bit of context about what's going on. Boniface, can you hear us?
Hello, hi, how are you?
Wonderful. So Boniface, we're just talking about the tragic sort of first abduction and killing of lawyer Willie Kimani and as well as the taxi driver the taxi was in and the client he was representing. And I think one thing we're really just trying to understand is why do you think, in your opinion, this has garnered such wide, sort of massive national reaction, this issue?
I think because a lawyer died. The killings have been very frequent. In this country, poor people get killed every day. Eventually, there's a killing in one part of the city where a young man shot dead the police because of a suspected gangster. But it was the first time you are killing a lawyer for representing a client. And that means that the police crossed the red line of going beyond suspected gangsters and terrorists, and they kill someone who's just doing his work. And Kenya has a very big lawyer fraternity, and the Willie Kimani was working for a US-based organization. So all those factors contribute to it becoming a very big issue in the country.
I mean, I hear you, and in looking at the statistics, I mean, the Kenya National Human Rights Commission has written that according to their statistics, that there's hundreds of extrajudicial killings happening every year. And you have other sort of watch bodies saying that up to 200-300 were happening in 2014 and 2015. So what you're saying is that really that people are only reacting because it was a higher profile member of society, because it was someone who's a lawyer, perhaps a respected profession, and that in the streets and in the slums that this happens all the time. Surely that's quite a tragic thing in itself, that we only react when certain people get killed.
It's because Kenya has a very weak judicial system. And the police think that when they kill criminals, they're trying to minimize crime in the city. So the middle class and the upper class have been looking the other way when poor people get killed. Because they're told by the police, you are killing those people to protect you. So the feeling is that when they kill those young and unknown men, they're killing to keep the city safe. And that is the reason why Kenyans have always looked the other way when they have killed those suspected criminals. But this was the case of killing three people who had no connection to any crime, no connection to anything that you could actually say they made any mistake. That's the reason why there's been a big uproar. But I think Kenyans have normalized police killings because it seems that police kill to defend and protect.
Boniface, do you think this is a turning point? Do you think now that sort of it's on the national sort of agenda, it's on the news, people are talking about, do you think this is a turning point in terms of the way the judicial system and the public hold police to account and what they expect policing to look like?
It's only going to be a turning point if we all rally together to stop the killing. Since Willie Kimani was killed and just started Joseph, there have been other killings. Today, one person was killed. Yesterday, two bodies were found down to the river. And the police have actually diversified the way they kill. So normally they used to shoot people. If you look at the way Willie Kimani and Joseph were killed, they were killed with a hammer, blunt objects. They were hit on the head, and then they were strangled. So the police have been doing this. So many of them, the killings have been tracked back to them. They don't use bullets to kill, or they don't use guns to kill. They're using machetes, they're using ropes, they're hanging people, they're doing all manner of things. But this time round, because of the April over Williams killing, I think there's a lot of attention towards that part of the police force. Yeah, the government has actually admitted they have hit squads to kill wanted robbers and all other people. And those, the misfits in society. However, because of Willie's death, there's a lot of focus on police reform, and we are hoping that could be the last. It will be the last killing for sure, but it's going to be the turning point for the country when it comes to extrajudicial killings.
I mean, what you're describing, is really torture and then executions. And I'm wondering, at what point do we have to hold the not only the police but the entire state accountable for what you're describing as the norm? That it's normal, even if somebody is suspected of being a criminal, it's normal for them to be hanged and their body found in the bottom of a river. It's normal for people to go missing. At what point do you think we have to hold the state accountable? And do you think the conversation happening in Kenya right now is pointing fingers also at the state for allowing this to happen so frequently?
I think we, as a society, we are partly to blame because it has been happening, we have never spoken about. But the reason why they torture these people before they kill them is for them to provide information. We believe as the civil rights civil society in Kenya that Willie wasn't killed because of that particular case. Willie was killed because he was investigating other killings, and he was also about a drug cartel of the police. And so they were torturing him to find out what he knew before they killed him. And there's a feeling amongst society that there's going to be more killings because what Willie knew, other people knew. And so the reason why we're making a lot of noise about it to ensure that it doesn't happen again, because the people who killed Willie had backing not only from the local police level, but from the police headquarters. There's no way you can kidnap someone and hold them overnight, then go and kill them in the morning without sanction from the government. So we can't even call the killing isolated. The killer was part of an entire police system that has actually conspired to become like a mafia system. Where normally in other countries it's the mafia who kill you. In Kenya, it's not the mafia who kill you. In Kenya, it's the police who kill you. If you look at the numbers of people who die in gunshot wounds in this country, the majority of people who are shot in this country are shot by the police. The majority of killers in this country are not done by gangsters, but police officers.
Sorry, Boniface, I'm just giving it a second to actually just think in what you're saying. And I'm just trying to think. You've mentioned the drug cartels that you suspect is a case that the lawyer was working on, and you think that could be behind, you know, his abduction and his killing. And I'm thinking back to sort of former Chief Justice in Kenya, Willie Mutunga, who once said that Kenya is really just a nation that's being run by a lot of cartels. And a lot of people saw that as, you know, a bit exaggerating, and then him sort of speaking out of turn. And what you're describing is that it sounds like that is the case, that there's a lot of underhanded activity. There's a massive sort of off the record, off the books, sort of drugs and power networks that are happening and that are controlling things behind the scenes. How exaggerated do you think that idea is, that there's massive sort of power brokers behind the scenes that can decide who lives and who dies?
It's so exaggerated. Kenya doesn't have a single jail, doesn't have a single corrupt big shot in jail. Because in Kenya, you are guilty until proven rich. You don't jail the rich people who commit crimes. So there's a writer called Bashaya Zaida who said, he said, in Kenya, the mafia is the state. And that's the truth. The guys who break the law, the guys who do smuggling, the guys who do drugs, all these sort of things, are inside the government. They are either politicians and other such people. Kenya has a reputation. If you Google drug barons in Kenya, the next name of the baron is a politician, because the people who do this thing have been elected into power. So it's the way Kenyans vote. They vote for the guys who have a lot of money. And the guys who have a lot of money have done a lot of bad things. So you have allowed, actually, the mafia to become part of the state and entrench itself in like an extension of the government. So in Kenya, the people who are doing ivory poaching, drug dealing, smuggling, are part of the government. If you look at the richest people in Kenya, they're politicians. What have they done? Nothing. You can't see what they're trading. So there's no obvious transaction or any business that you can see that they've been doing. Nothing. So it's a fact. You just need to Google drugs in Kenya or mafia in Kenya, and you find that it's the government that comes on top.
I hear you, Boniface. One of my final questions before we let you go, just to bring it back to the three people who were kidnapped and killed, and back to the police question. Do you think, given how wide and systemic the issues you've just mentioned are, do you think there's any meaningful police reform that people can rally around or discuss or push forward that you think can be the first step towards curbing this issue that's being described of extrajudicial killings?
There are no police reforms. It's a lie. So let's not talk about police reforms. That's a joke. It's like washing a pig's feet and then let it play in the mud. There's no change.
So what needs to happen?
Yeah.
So what do you think needs to happen if the police reform is just really not an option?
I think we need to get... I don't think they're not very... They don't agree with me.
That's okay.
But I've been saying we need to get... I think this country needs to get foreigners to come and help us with the structure and push the police reforms. If an identity is job, you can't start it to actually reform itself. We need an external partner to come and help us do that. When Kenya got involved in terrorism and other issues, and they've been hit by terrorists, we got foreign experts from Israel, from the US, from British Commonwealth, our police officers on how to track terrorist attacks and prevent terror attacks. Now we're talking about a rotten police system. What do you need to do? You need to get the same foreigners who have been able to help us in the world as terror to come and help us fight and clean up the police force. The police service cannot be trusted to clean itself. The guys who are in the rank and file of the police force have been there for so long and they're extremely rotten. So you need to get a foreigner to come and help us do that. In the 80s, Kenya had a shortage of judges in the High Court. And the then President Moi did was actually hire foreign judges who are qualified. I think Kenya needs to hire foreign police officers or people who can be able to train our officers on debate and investigation. The other thing that needs to happen is that we don't hire police based on qualification, school, academic level. You hire officers based on how fast they can run around a playfield. So when you hire idiots, you're going to get idiots in the streets with guns. And you need to stop hiring idiots if you need to reform our police force.
Okay. Boniface Mwangi, thank you so much for talking to us. And I hope next time you're on, we can really spend the hour with you. That'll be wonderful.
All right. Thank you so much for the call.
Perfect. Thank you. Before we jump into a break, just immediate thoughts on that. I think one, I think it's just so interesting when we always talk about the idea of African solutions to African problems. And to hear an activist who's knee deep in the fight for human rights in Kenya, saying that a country or police force is beyond sort of redemption at a local level and needs expert advice and experts, and saying, you know, let's not rely on our own sort of ethics and morality and get other experts and other people to come in and teach us how to police and teach us how to reform our police system is really, it's a hard thing to hear based on a lot of the conversations we have. And secondly, I think I like the idea. It's comforting to me when we discuss sort of a police issue to find that it's narrow and that it's clean and all you have to do is ABC and everything is sorted. But when you hear that it's linked to politicians and it's linked to sort of drug barons, I mean, it's I suppose two things. One, it can sound very exaggerated, despite a lot of people saying that, listen, this is what's happening. And two, it can just sound really overwhelming and feel like there's sort of no recourse for that. I realize I'm rambling now. Gonna go into a quick break. We'll be right back.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. Live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Just sort of digging in for the second half of the show. On what seems to be a running theme from the last sort of segment we just did, talking about policing and extrajudicial killings in Kenya, seems to be something that we've sort of been talking about on the international conversation, if there is such a thing as international conversation, and talking about what's happening in America. This is not the first time that there's been a focus on what appears to be it being a very dangerous to be a sort of black man in America in the face of the police. When we remember the names like Freddie Gray and Trayvon Martin, which was very young people going about their daily lives and finding themselves sort of dead at the end of the day after an encounter with the police. So last week, what we saw, we saw 37-year-old Alton Sterling was shot and killed. That was in Louisiana. We saw 32-year-old Philando Castile shot and killed. That was in Minnesota. And I think just having two in such close proximity, it just felt like things are getting much worse. At least that's the sense I got all the way from here. And we're trying to speak to somebody who's sort of on the ground there to give us a sense of what the emotions are like there. And then after that, we saw what happened in Dallas, where an individual, Micah Johnson, who shot and killed five police officers and wounded another seven. And that also sort of somewhat felt as perhaps an inevitable response. And we can also sort of sense check that to see if that's fair to say. Greg, I remember covering this, was it a year ago? And we were just sitting here saying, like, where do we go from here? There seem to be so many underlying issues. The issues of sort of inequality and marginalization of black people in America. The issue of gun control, which comes up so many times. And the issue that there's more guns than people in America. There's more guns per person in America than any country on the planet. There's issues of policing, which, as we've just been discussing, seems to be perhaps even an international thing of what does modern policing look like? What does fair policing look like?
Ironic as well, as we're speaking to Boniface, talking about looking to international sort of policing forces to take lessons to train Kenyan police. And now, obviously, we're talking about the American, the different forces, police forces in America and their challenges.
And something that's come up for me also is just this sort of false binary that I find quite interesting. I think Trevor Noah spoke a bit about it on The Daily Show. And he mentioned that it's sort of come to a point where you're either or. And if you're pro Black Lives Matter, then you're anti-police, right? And if you support the police and understand the sort of the responsibility behind the badge and the responsibility that police face and the dangers they face, then automatically you're against the protesters. And when I hear that, I just think that's such a dangerous sort of place to be. We already have a lot of divisions amongst race and so on. I just feel like that's such a dangerous division. We were talking a bit about that. I don't know what do you see there.
No, I also sort of saw, I think from the president's response and other sort of leaders in America, I actually think I saw that there was sort of quite a middle line, and I think perhaps calling right now in the heat of the moment of as everything's going on, calling for sort of calm from both sides and looking to try and overcome those divisions, but whether that sort of will turn into practice and reality, I think is we'll wait to see.
I mean, I hear you. I mean, this is such a complicated issue, and we're just going to try and just quickly go on Skype for this. So we'll be speaking to Professor Justin Hansford, who we've had on the show before, was part of the Black Lives Matter movement.
He's an activist, and I think he lives just 10 minutes away from Ferguson, where obviously Mike Brown was killed, and obviously that got huge international attention. And sort of Justin, I think a lot of our listeners might remember having him on the show. He sort of faced arrest for his protesting efforts, and then he co-authored the Ferguson to Geneva Human Rights Shadow Report, and he accompanied the Ferguson protesters and Mike Brown's family to Geneva to testify in front of the new United Nations about these sort of issues. And he was also a Fulbright scholar, and I think has an interesting crossover between South Africa and the States, because he was over here researching some of South Africa's legal issues freshly after coming and being very closely involved in these issues in the States and the Black Lives Matter movement there.
I know one thing, as we just sort of sorted out the Skype line, I know one thing that he brought up that I found quite interesting was just how unifying, at least amongst a lot of Black people, the emotions were, whether you're in Baltimore or over. Now we're seeing issues in Tennessee, we're seeing issues in Louisiana, just how unifying it was. And Greg, I'm curious about what you think about this. I was speaking to some sort of activists on this side and sort of some pro-Black thinkers down in Kenya and in South Africa, and a lot of them feel that perhaps the focus and the wide media attention and individual focus on what's going on in America with Black Lives Matter and policing is misplaced. And it's saying, hey, we've got our own issues here in Africa, we've got issues here in South Africa. Why are you dedicating so much time to mourning at Trayvon Martin? Why are you dedicating time to mourning Alton Sterling? And do you pay as much attention to Marikana? Do you pay as much attention when Vitz Justice Project released a report about torture on this side? And I'm curious what you think about that. Do you see it as a distraction? Do you see it as perhaps one sort of unified body? What do you think?
Actually, funny you say that. We actually just got a couple of tweets about that, I think. Yeah. At only one Heather and at Comrade Question both suggested that instead of focusing on issues in America, we should be looking at what's happening with the protests and the issues in Zimbabwe. I think that's a really good question, King. I often sort of think about that myself. Yep. And I think a lot of people maybe had like a bit of a shock when this week, I think the statistics about police killings in South Africa were compared to the killings by police of citizens in the US. And South Africa has a higher per capita death rate. It also has a higher, I would assume, a higher per capita amount of police that get killed than probably in the US. But I think it's sort of, while everybody was outraged that obviously all the violence and the travesties that's going on across America at the moment, to sort of see that, oh shit, you know, things can be pretty bad here too, and are we focusing enough attention on them? I don't think it's a, particularly from a media practitioner's point of view, I don't think it's wrong at all to focus on these issues internationally, and I think they can often feed back into each other. For example, sort of reminds me of an example in Australia where back in I think it was the 60s and a part of Australia called Redfern that's in Sydney, there's an indigenous it's had a big indigenous population there, and it was the same time that sort of civil rights movement was happening in the US, and the movement in Australia drew a lot of lessons from what was happening with Black nationalists and civil rights leaders in America, and they brought that back and sort of infused their own campaigns and protest action with some of those lessons. And I think there can be positives with that in terms of learning from each other, spreading a word, and also I'd imagine for something like Black Lives Matter and these situations is perhaps a bit of a sharing of similar stories. Perhaps someone who's experienced racism in South Africa can understand and relate, and also want to know more about situations of racism that might correlate in other parts of the world. That said, I think we do need to have a much stronger focus on our own issues, and the suggestions that we should be focusing on Zimbabwe, I think were very valid, because, you know, these Zimbabwe is a neighboring country. South Africa has a huge influence on Zim and vice versa. And I think it's crucial that we really do also focus on what's going on in South Africa, in the region, in our own communities and towns and cities. Because essentially, at the end of the day, that's where we live and the places we interact with. But I think it's false to ask the question as a binary. I don't think it's, must we watch American news and not look at anything local or vice versa. We can spend our time on both, I think, and understanding what's happening in the world while also understanding what's happening closer to home.
Yeah, and how those things are similar and different, right? There's a bunch of similarities, but also there's a lot of things that are very different, and I think that's okay. It's weird. We find ourselves just sort of dismantling these false binaries a lot of the time. Mm. Sort of one thing that's worth, I know this has been said a lot, but there's something here about the policing aspects, and I'm thinking especially about the article you shared from the Fitz Justice Project around what is classified as non-lethal weapons, and how a lot of the focus on policing is often about trying to get them to use non-lethal weapons. And the study found, and we'll share this again, that a lot of non-lethal weapons were being used for torture. So a lot of electroshocking devices, and a lot of ways to sort of tie people up and hurt people. And for me, that just drove home this idea of there seems to be an international thing about policing and how force is used and how force is not used. And there just seems to be something very, very wrong.
I just think it's a sort of challenging and complicated situation that police forces across the world will sort of find, and particularly when there are prejudices involved, when there's extreme anger and perhaps a violent or a bad police officer, for lack of a better word. Whether they're using, I still think it's probably better that they have non-lethal weapons than lethal weapons that they choose to use. But even using non-lethal weapons, you know, if you have a taser, you can obviously tase someone way too many times, yeah. or leave shocking them for far too long. And excuse me, this is one of the biggest issues that came up in the Marikana Commission too, yeah. where. It was talked about the use of non-lethal, means in protest, yeah. yeah, and effectively it found that they weren't used properly at the right time, or as a preventative tool enough. So I think the example there is everybody now knows the famous or infamous images of some of the striking workers coming off the kopi. And what people actually mostly know is of them, their final moments approaching that line of tactical response team, SAPS officers, and all getting gunned down in machine gun fire. But what actually happened before that was they slowly marched around, you know, I don't know, a distance of 100, 150 meters, something like that, maybe a little bit less. And so the barbed wire the police had tried to roll out was ineffective because they just managed to sort of get there before the barbed wire was fully rolled out, and it even scared them. And then when a water cannon was finally used only moments before the final killings. So first of all, it could have been used much earlier. And then also it actually had the effect of pushing people towards police officers armed with deadly weapons. So I think there's a lot of cases where people have to learn, and I think police departments and forces must learn these things from the get-go, because you can't get in a situation and then hope to figure it out yeah. while you're there, because it can obviously end up in fatalities.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the most sort of depressing things that I've heard people saying, and it's often just one of these little Twitter quotes, was just this thing of saying that the violence is not new, what's new is the cameras. And it's, I think that's just such a sort of a, Not untrue, but a really sort of sad thing to hear, of saying that people have been saying we are getting killed in different places. The thing that has changed is that now you can put it on Facebook Live. Now you can tweet it. Now there's media attention, whereas before it was just sort of hearsay.
Most certainly. And I think that will hopefully, although it's extremely shocking and painful to see all these stories come out, at least when these killings come out, at least now people know about them. Because you assume that in the past they were also going on, like you said, and we just didn't know about them. And hopefully through these, I think, moments of pain and extreme divisions and really sort of trying times, that at least there can be improvements now that you can't keep these issues off the table anymore. Yep. You can't pretend that these things aren't happening anymore. And hopefully now that we're at this situation, that the status quo can be finally changed.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we've really struggled to get Justin on the line. And what I'll do, we'll make time to actually Skype with him between now and next week, and we'll see if we can upload that separately as one of the podlets that we try to bring, a bonus special. And a couple of things we didn't get to. So, of course, the Zim protests and Zim stairways is something that's happening. They're supposed to be back on tomorrow and the next day. And also, today is David Cameron's last day as Prime Minister, if I'm not wrong.
Mm.
And
they're set to have their second female Prime Minister ever. So,
something to watch. All right. We'll catch you on Twitter. I'll share some of the things I've mentioned. So, the Vitz Justice Project article. I'll also share some of the reports around Kenyan policing and extrajudicial killings and anything else. If you want any of the references or links that we referred to during the show, please just let us know and we'll share them. Thank you very much. So great to be back. Please download and share the podcast far and wide. We'll see you next week on the Daily Maverick Show, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
This is cliffcentral.com.